Due to the graphic nature of this case, listener discretion is advised, especially for those 13 and under. The spring of 1971 in Washington, D.C. was in full fervor. While the civil rights movement was simmering down, the war in Vietnam was the main topic on people's minds. Protesters were hitting the streets, coming from all over the nation to protest America's involvement in the conflict. The Metropolitan Police of the District of Columbia, or MPDC for short, were out in full force patrolling the demonstrations in the nation's capital, handling the hundreds of detainees in makeshift detainment camps on the city streets. Within the southeast quadrant of the city, a predator lurked its streets, looking for its first victim to become his prey. In total, six African-American girls ranging in age from 10 to 18 years old would be abducted, sexually assaulted, and killed. Their bodies dumped along freeways with the explicit purpose of being discovered. For nearly 2 years, no one felt safe knowing that it was only a matter of time before this callous murderer would strike again, taking another young girl just steps from her home. On this episode of Criminal Intent, we will look into the cases that are considered to be committed by Washington, D.C.'s first serial killer, the Freeway Phantom Murders. Welcome to Criminal Intent, a podcast that dissects crime one episode at a time. I'm your host, Deandra Cannoli, and this podcast is available to you on most podcast streaming platforms. If you like what you hear, please give us a positive rating wherever you're listening if the option is available. It would really help us get the word out about the show. If you would like updates about Criminal Intent, please feel free to follow us on Twitter at CrimIntentPod. That's C-R-I-M Intent Pod, or follow us on Instagram at Criminal Intent Pod. And now, we'll dive into the details of the Freeway Phantom Murders. On the evening of April 25th, 1971, Carol Denise Spinks, known as Bebe to the family, was at home with her siblings. Her mother, Alantine, left to visit an aunt across the border in Brentwood, Maryland. Alantine had a strict rule for the kids. If she had to leave the house for a while, no one was allowed to answer the door or to leave the apartment. And if she were to find out anyone had broken that rule, there was a punishment waiting for them. During the time Alantine was away, Carol's older sister, Valerie, was in the apartment across the hall. Valerie, who was 24 years old at the time, did not live in the apartment with her other siblings. Wanting some items from the nearby 7-Eleven, Valerie knocked on Alantine's door to try to get one of her siblings to go to the store for her. None of them wanted to go, knowing the prospect of a whipping was more than likely to happen if they were caught. Valerie became angry. She yelled and pounded on the door and continued to do so until Carol finally acquiesced, not wanting Valerie to continue to make a scene. She left the apartment with the $5 Valerie gave her and walked down to the 7-Eleven, about half a mile away from the apartment complex on Wheeler Road, just over the Maryland border in Prince George's County. The minutes started ticking by, and what should have been a quick trip was now nearing 30 minutes, and Carol had not returned home. The feeling of concern started to grow inside her older sister Evander's gut. She went across the hall to ask if Carol had returned. "She hasn't came back yet?" Valerie asked. With that response, Evander's concern deepened. She ran up to the 7-Eleven and asked the cashier about Carol. The cashier said that her sister had indeed come into the store and left with TV dinners, bread, and sodas in hand. When Evander arrived home, Carol still had not returned. A little while later, Alantine arrived back home and noticed that Carol was absent from the house. She immediately called the police. However, the response from the police was rather surprising and worrying. She was told that Carol had simply ran away from home. Alantine and Carol's siblings did not believe for a second that she would have ran away. Carol was a happy girl. She and her identical twin sister Carolyn were very close. Being small and rather shy, she was adored by her family. Both Evander and Carolyn expressed that she would have never ran away. It wasn't in her character to do so. Taking matters into her own hands, Alantine, along with family, friends, and neighbors, headed out to search for Carol, but they didn't find any sign of her. Alantine had seen her daughter earlier that day on her way to the store, and she had chastised Carol for leaving the apartment. Alantine told Carol that she would see her when she got home. Little did she know, this would be the last time she would ever speak or see her daughter again. 6 days later, a police officer discovered a body of a young girl fully clothed, but with no shoes on her feet, along Route 295 behind St. Elizabeth's Hospital. The body was identified to be Carol's. According to the coroner's report, Carol had bruises and abrasions on her face, neck, chest, and both of her hands. She had contusions around her neck from being strangled, and there was evidence that she was sodomized. The coroner found something unexpected inside of Carol, undigested citrus fruit in her stomach, which indicated that she was alive for much of the time she was gone. Green synthetic fiber was also found on her body. The investigators on the case came to the house to tell the family the news. Carol's twin sister, Carolyn Spinks Morris, recalled, "The homicide detectives came to my house, and I heard my mother scream and holler from somewhere in the back, and that's how I found out. The news was devastating. I felt like I let my sister down," Evander said. "I shouldn't have let her out the house." Police set out canvassing the area to gather information. They found a 14-year-old who was on the way to the 7-Eleven with her mother and sister and saw Carol walking on Wheeler Road carrying a bag. From this information and the accounts from Alantine and the cashier, the police deduced that someone had taken her close to her house as she was returning home. Unfortunately, the effort to continue to canvass the area for more tips would cease quickly. Because of the Vietnam War protests and the need to keep order in the makeshift camps full of detained protesters, every available police officer was called on emergency duty. The police had locked up the most people they had ever had, and there was nowhere to store these people, former MPDC Detective Romaine Jenkins recounted in a documentary by People magazine on the case. Jenkins remembered that when she was going to head out to Southeast DC to follow up on the case, her superior stopped her. Jenkins said, quote, "He asked, 'Where are you going?' And I said I was going to follow up on the case of the little girl found in Southeastern. He said, 'Nope, the whole department is on prisoner alert, and that includes homicide squad.' So I couldn't go." This was unusual, Jenkins said in the interview for the print publication, The Freelance Star, quote, "because murder, as far as we were concerned, took precedence," end quote. Evander said that there wasn't much of a police presence at all, and this angered the family and the community. Evander said, quote, "As far as looking on the streets for my sister's killer, the police were hardly ever around, and we were mad as hell because if this could happen to my sister, it could happen to anyone," end quote. Unfortunately, that would be the fate of another neighborhood girl. Just a little over 2 months later, and just a few blocks away from where Carol Spinks lived and was abducted, the phantom would strike again. 16-year-old Darlenia Denise Johnson set out on the morning of July 8, 1971, to go to her part-time job at Oxon Hills Recreation Center. However, she would never arrive there. When her mother, Helen, realized that she had not returned home in a timely manner, she grew very concerned and filed a missing persons report. Day after day went by without any word of where Darlenia was, and someone would make sure that Darlenia's mother would never feel a sense of security. She would receive phone calls from a person that would never identify themselves. Each time Helen would pick up the phone, the person on the other end would not say anything. Breathing would be the only sound she would hear. Helen hoped that it was her daughter trying to contact her. However, the last call she would receive would send a chill down anyone's spine. Former Detective Romaine Jenkins recounted, "The last call was a man on the other end of the line, and he says,
'I killed your daughter. Nothing else to see.'"
The man hung up after that. Helen called the police to report the calls, but the police at the time didn't have the technology to do call tracing. During the time Darlenia was missing, two people called the police to report spotting what they saw was potentially a body. Two patrol officers were dispatched onto the scene. They drove by in their patrol car, but they didn't spot the body that was allegedly reported to be in the area. On July 19th, 11 days from the time she was abducted, Darlenia's body was discovered along the roadside of Interstate 295, just 15 feet away from where Carol Spink's body was found. Darlenia's body was in an advanced state of decomposition, so much so that she could not be identified by facial recognition alone. Instead, the police went through a list of missing persons. Using the description of her clothing, they were able to make a positive identification. Even though the official cause of death could not be determined due to the condition of her body, police were convinced that she had been murdered. Only a few days later, after Darlenia was found, the Phantom would claim its next victim. With two girls murdered in the same neighborhood, parents were on high alert. They warned their children not to venture out alone. With potential prey staying inside, the killer moved to the northwest quadrant of Washington, D.C., prowling around for his next victim. It only took 8 days for him to find her. Brenda Faye Crockett was a precocious 10-year-old who was pretty popular, wasn't camera shy, and loved going to church. On the evening of July 27th, Brenda's family were in good spirits getting ready to settle down to watch a movie together. Around 8 p.m., Brenda's mother, Aretha, asked Brenda to go to the local Safeway supermarket near 14th Street and U Street, about a block and a half away from her home, to pick up some bread and dog food for the family's three dogs. She set out with her pink foam curlers in her hair, her blue and white printed halter top and shorts set, and no shoes for the short trip. Aretha thought Brenda would bring a friend along, but she went alone. When an hour passed and there was no sign of Brenda, Aretha knew something wasn't quite right. Brenda was a responsible girl, so it was unusual for her to stay out late. Brenda's mother decided to go out to look for her, while Brenda's 7-year-old sister, Bertha, stayed home with Aretha's boyfriend, staying there to watch over Bertha. Around 9:20 p.m., the telephone rang. Bertha picked up the phone to hear Brenda crying on the other end. "Mama's going to look for you," Brenda told her sister, according to the police file, which contained the reconstruction of the conversation. Brenda proceeded to tell Bertha that a white man had snatched her up and that she believed she was in Virginia. She also said that she was heading home in a cab. "I could remember thinking, why would you have to be picked up when the store was right around the corner?" Bertha recalled in the People magazine documentary on the case. Soon after, Brenda abruptly said bye and hung up. But then, around 25 minutes later, the phone rang again. This time, Aretha's boyfriend picked up the phone. It was Brenda once more. She repeated the same message that she told Bertha. He urged her to tell him where she was, and she said that she was in Virginia, just as she told her sister earlier. However, this time she asked a seemingly odd question. I remember Brenda asking, "Did my mom see me?" Bertha recalled. And I remember my dad saying, "Well, if your mom saw you, she would have gotten you." And she was crying. She was confused and she didn't know what was about to happen to her. The boyfriend then asked Brenda to put the man on the phone. He could make out heavy footsteps in the background, but nothing else. "Well, I'll see you later," Brenda whispered before the phone abruptly hung up once more. When Retha arrived home after searching for Brenda, Bertha and her boyfriend told her about the phone calls. Retha immediately called the police to report that her daughter was missing. The police interviewed the family and started to look into the situation. However, Brenda would soon be found in a matter of hours. The next day, a hitchhiker was traveling along Route 50 near Interstate 295 in Prince George's County, Maryland. Around 5:50 a.m., the hitchhiker spotted the body of a small child and alerted the police. The 4-foot-6-inch, 75-pound body that the hitchhiker found was little Brenda. She had been strangled. The scarf used to kill her was still knotted around her neck. She had also been raped. Green synthetic fibers were found on her clothes, and her feet were incredibly clean. Considering that she had walked to the store barefoot, her feet would have most likely had some dirt on them. However, it seemed to the investigators that her murderer had taken time to clean her feet before placing her body down beside the freeway. The investigators reviewed the calls to see if they could possibly get any clues from them. Former Detective Romaine Jenkins believed that perhaps the calls were really to see if Brenda's mother had actually seen him, the murderer, with Brenda,
maybe while she was searching for her.
Perhaps the killer knew Retha and would have recognized him if she had spotted him with Brenda. "Why would you let her call home, not once but twice?" Jenkins said in a 2018 interview with the Washington Post. He had to make sure that her mother didn't see her. Because the killer was worried about being spotted, investigators believe that the calls were scripted by the perpetrator to hamper the investigation. He was most likely not a white man, and she was most likely not in Virginia. Now, with a third girl murdered and left by the side of the freeway in a very similar style to the other two prior murders, the news reporters were out in droves talking to concerned citizens in the neighborhoods. While the police were keeping quiet about the details, the media was starting to speculate that perhaps these killings were connected in some way. The city was on high alert as they followed the story in the press. "The news will tell you more than what the police will tell you," Evander Spinks-Belk said in her interview for the People magazine documentary. With the killer on the move, no one was safe. And 2 months later, the freeway phantom would take his next victim in the northeast quadrant of D.C. Twelve-year-old Nina Moshe Yates, or Nino, as she was affectionately called by her family and friends, was sent out to the local Safeway supermarket just a block and a half away from her home on the 4900 block of Benning Road on the evening of October 1st, 1971. Her father had sent her to the store to buy some sugar, flour, and some paper plates. Her father was going to go to the hospital to visit her stepmother who had just had a baby. Nino got the items and headed back to the apartment. But somewhere within the short journey back to her home, she was abducted. This time, it didn't take long for someone to find her. Just 2 hours later, a 16-year-old boy came across Nino's body, still warm to the touch, along Pennsylvania Avenue in St. George's County. Authorities arrived on the scene soon after the discovery. Nino was raped and was strangled. Green synthetic fibers were found on her just like the ones found on Carol and Brenda before. It was at this point, with four murders of young African-American girls, three confirmed to be sexually assaulted and strangled, and left in the open by busy highways to be discovered, the media was doubling down on the idea that these murders were really connected by the same killer.
The media dubbed this potential killer the Freeway Phantom. It was clear that the perpetrator used the I-295 beltway as a getaway to go to neighborhoods that he was most likely familiar with to stalk his victims. It was also a way to make an escape. However, the authorities were not sold on this idea that the murders were quite connected. Unlike now, where the general public has become familiar with the likes of Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and Jeffrey Dahmer, police and the public did not have the frame of reference for such a string of murders. The idea of a serial killer was novel. The term serial killer is believed to be coined around 1974, a few years after the Freeway Phantom killings were believed to have stopped. It wouldn't be until the early 1980s when the term was first used in the U.S. media. The idea that one person was capable of killing multiple people over a span of time was not something in the minds of many investigators in 1971. But now, with four girls dead, there was a clear need for more assistance with these cases. The Federal Bureau of Investigation, or the FBI, stepped in to assist with the forensic investigation, as the police department's crime lab had not yet grown to the extent that they are currently. The pressure was on to find out what exactly was going on, and to find out who was responsible for these girls' deaths. Another killing could happen at any time, and no one knew where or when it would be, or to whom. Unfortunately, the time would come 6 weeks later. Eighteen-year-old Brenda Woodard finished her night classes on the evening of November 15, 1971. As usual, she accompanied a classmate to Ben's Chili Bowl, a landmark establishment in the D.C. area, known for their chili dogs, half-smokes, and milkshakes. Typically, Brenda's classmate would drive her home after classes, but this time his car was in the shop. So they both got on the bus to head home. They traveled together up until they reached 8th Street and H Street in Northeast D.C., where she got off to transfer to another bus. However, Brenda would never make it home. Brenda's body would be found some 6 hours later after she was last seen leaving the bus. Officer David Norman spotted Brenda on a grassy area just south of the Route 202 access ramp near Prince George's Hospital, at around 5 a.m. the next day. Brenda's burgundy-colored crushed velvet coat was placed atop of her. Buttons were missing off of her coat and off her skirt. Her black turtleneck sweater was inside out. Like the other girls, she was raped and strangled, but this time she was stabbed 4 times. Defensive wounds were found on her hands, showing that she fought her attacker. There was one added detail that was not seen in the cases prior to this one. The killer made their first attempt to speak directly to the police. In one of Brenda's coat pockets was a note. The note said, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me, if you can." The note was peculiar in several ways. The handwriting analysis done on the note by the Joint Task Force for this case found that it was Brenda's handwriting. According to the analysis, the strokes of her letters did not show any sense of nervousness, no shakiness, or trembling in her strokes. Investigators suspected that she may not have felt in danger when she wrote it. They also believe that the killer told her what to write down. Investigators also speculated that the perpetrator could have possibly been in the military at some point in time. The style was reminiscent of communication given in the military. The message itself seemed to reveal a motive behind the murderer's actions. He had some sort of grudge against females. The particular use of the word tantamount was something that stood out to detectives as well. Barry Culvert, former special agent with the FBI from 1962 to 1997, said, "Tantamount. You don't use that word. Why would you have somebody spell that? I thought that the note was being directed at someone in particular." He was saying that the reason he did this is because you made judgment of me. This person was getting even with someone or something.
Despite having this new piece of evidence and tips pouring in, the investigators were still no closer to having any solid leads than before. Weeks and then months went by with no other clues and no other victims. The murderer seemed to have vanished, but in time, he would make one last move. Ten months went by without any news of any new abductions from the Freeway Phantom, which was, in a sense, a relief that no other young girl was attacked and killed by this nebulous perpetrator. However, there was still a sense of unease. The investigation team was no closer to finding out who had killed the other five girls. The media and the public were pushing for answers. It was speculated that once the media coverage reached its height, and the FBI was announced to be on the case, the Freeway Phantom possibly decided it was not safe for him to strike once more. Other investigators, including Romaine Jenkins, suspected that perhaps something went wrong during the Brenda Woodard abduction. Romaine speculated in the A&E TV show, The Case I Can't Forget, that Brenda put up a big fight, which possibly deterred the killer for a while. But the cool-off period would come to an end on the evening of September 5th, 1972. 17-year-old Diane Williams had her mind on going to see her boyfriend James for a few hours. Patricia Williams, Diane's younger sister, said that she had recently gotten into boys and that James was her first love. Diane's parents gave her the permission to go and visit him on the condition that she came back by 10 p.m. Diane went on her way and made it to her boyfriend's house. Once it was time for her to leave, James accompanied her to the bus stop and waited with her until the bus came. She got on the bus and headed home, but 10 p.m. came and went, and she still hadn't came through the door. A few hours later, on the morning of September 6th, a truck driver pulled on the side of the road on I-295 just outside of the district line. He made a gruesome discovery, a teenage girl lying dead with her shoes off. He called the police, who came to investigate the scene. The girl's white sneakers had Diane written along the soles in marker ink. The girl was confirmed to be Diane Williams. It was determined that Diane was strangled to death, and with the way she was disposed of in plain view on the side of I-295, investigators believed that the Phantom took Diane's life. She was found with green fibers on her body, the same kind that was on all of the other victims except for Darlenia Johnson. Her autopsy would reveal that she showed no signs of sexual assault, but there were traces of semen on her. The investigators originally assumed that it had came from James since she had went over to his place. However, he claimed that he had not had any sexual intercourse with her that evening. The semen sample was not tested at that time. Then, as suddenly as he came, the Phantom disappeared. The deaths of the canonical six, Carol Spinks, Darlenia Johnson, Brenda Crockett, Nina Moshe Yates, Brenda Woodard, and Diane Williams would haunt Washington, D.C. for years to come. But one is left to ask, what happened to the Freeway Phantom? Why did he stop with Denise Williams? Some would argue that the Freeway Phantom may have claimed at least one more victim before heading underground, which we will discuss that, the suspects, and the big reason why this case has not been solved yet in part two of Criminal Intent's The Freeway Phantom Murders. I hope you've enjoyed what you heard so far. If you like the content of Criminal Intent, please give us a positive rating on the podcast platform you use if possible. I know that some of the platforms don't have a rating system or a commenting system. So if you can't do that, just tell your friends and family who might be interested in the podcast. Also, please make sure to follow us on Instagram at Criminal Intent Pod or on Twitter at Crim Intent Pod. That's CRIM Intent Pod.
for news and updates on the podcast. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time for part 2.